Hello, Latimer. Where have you been all afternoon?
I've been recovering our time machine, Mum.
At last! Well done. Just in time to take tea with my friend.
I have some good news and some bad news. Which would you prefer to hear first?
The bad news.
Very good, Mum. As you recall, the time machine was stolen by Adam Christopher's evil future self, Christoph Adam. I'm afraid it has been used for some nefarious anti-cake purposes.
Heavens!
But the good news is that even though it was damaged in the scuffle, I have managed to repair it. But it no longer creates a protective time bubble. Instead, it creates this.
Oh. Oh, I'm not sure about this at all, Latimer.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman.
There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't been forced into saving the galaxy after getting a new record score on your favourite arcade game. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea lair for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and, of course, a nice cup of tea. I'm sorry about the time portal. It's a little unsettling when one steps through it, but Latimer assures me it's stable. Do let me know if you start to suffer any horrific side effects, such as vomiting, uncontrollable urges to sing Rick Astley songs, or the mistaken belief that you're a tribble. It is a little disconcerting being without the protective bubble we enjoyed before, but at least we have tea and cake to steady our nerves. I do hope the hats and coats that Latimer obtained for your disguises are comfortable. As you saw on the way here from the time portal, we're in the city of Bath in the late 17th century. The townhouse Latimer has found for us provides a wonderful view out into the street, and just over there is Bath Abbey. Whilst I would normally be very happy to visit this time and location, I do feel ethically bound to tell you that I didn't choose it myself. Latimer, why are we in the city of Bath in the 1680s?
This was the last space-time location the time machine was set to before I recovered it, Mum.
Does that mean that Christoph Adam could be here?
Possibly, Mum.
In that case, my lovelies, please keep your eyes open. I'm sure there will be time to take tea and have a little bit of cake before anything untoward happens.
Your guest has arrived, Mum. A Miss Myr Lafferty.
Oh, splendid. Let's see her calling card. Myr Lafferty, author, podcaster, eater of souls. Eater of souls? Oh, dear. I'm not sure we have the right cutlery for that.
I've only prepared light refreshments, Mum, not souls.
Well, hopefully it won't be a problem, then. Show her in, Latimer.
Very good, Mum.
For those of you who don't know, Myr Lafferty is a novelist and podcaster. She won the John W. Campbell Award 2012 for Best New Writer and is the author of the Shambling Guidebooks. Myr is also the creator of the award-winning I Should Be Writing podcast.
Ms. Myr Lafferty, Mum.
Hello, Myr. Do come and sit down. How are you?
Miss Newman, it's lovely to see you. Thank you for having me over.
Oh, it's my pleasure indeed. It's lovely to see you again. Would you like some tea?
Please.
How do you take your tea?
Two sugars, please.
No milk. Here we go. And I was wondering if you would like a Bath bun, seeing as we are in the very city of its origin.
Oh, my goodness, yes, please. I would very much like that, although I've never had one before, so I'm curious.
They're like a kind of a combination between a kind of normal bun and a brioche. And they have currants and they're kind of sugary and very, very nice. And then you have a really horrific sugar crash about 20 minutes later. But whilst you're having the bun, it's fantastic.
Mm. Well, currants are suspicious, but I'm willing to be adventurous. So please, yes, I would.
Marvellous. So there's something that I wanted to ask you before we get much further. Your calling card said eater of souls. Is that literal?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell what exactly a soul is. Sometimes, where I come from, when people die, they believe their souls enter whatever's in the room, such as the candy bar on the dresser or the basket of fruit that someone sent as a get-well-soon gift. And when I was a child, when my grandmother died, I was freaking out, and I just, you know, I eat when I'm nervous. So I grabbed the candy bar on her dresser, and my mother, horrified, told me I'd eaten her soul. And it didn't taste like anything different, you know, a bit like caramel. So after that, I figured souls were tasty, and I went around looking for more, and I would sneak into deathbed rooms and see what I could eat.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm actually quite relieved. Being someone quite prone to anxiety, I started to think, well, goodness, is there a correct way to eat souls? You know, do I need to worry about the cutlery at formal dinners? But it sounds like this is something very different to what I had in mind.
I'm terribly sorry. I should have been more specific. A sneak eater of souls. How's that? Because usually when people are sneak eating, they do not worry about cutlery or the proper fork or whether the napkin is still on the plate or in the lap.
But anyway, we don't need to worry about such things here.
No.
And in the invitation I extended to you, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
I have brought my favorite weapon of choice, which is my Tai Chi sword, given to me by my father when I started doing Tai Chi.
Wow, you know, swords are not something that I associate with Tai Chi.
Oh, they're beautiful. Have you ever seen Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon?
Yes.
That the sword that is the MacGuffin in that movie is a Tai Chi sword. It is long and straight, slightly bendy, with a tassel on the end.
Oh, they are very beautiful.
Yes, they are.
And this one is very beautiful as well.
Yes, it has a black handle and with a red dragon painted on and a red dragon etched into the blade.
Fantastic. So do you do Tai Chi often?
I don't anymore, but I did heavily several years ago, and I was starting to learn the Tai Chi sword form.
Oh, wow. That sounds really wonderful. I'll have to go and look that up online. I've only done a tiny, tiny bit of Tai Chi, but there were no swords involved, unfortunately.
There should always be swords involved.
Yes. See, this is why we get along.
Yes.
I love swords so much. I did kendo for a little while at university.
Ooh.
And that was really, really enjoyable. But, of course, I didn't get to use proper swords because then we'd kill people.
Yes. That's with a wooden sword, correct?
Yeah, I had like a wooden training sword that's mm-hmm. quite heavy that I do all the exercises with, and then like a bamboo sword for when you're sparring that make a really, really impressive thwack sound when you wallop somebody.
Nice.
It's very cool. So Mighty Mer is how I know you online with your Twitter handle, and to me that sounds like a superhero name, and I was wondering if you could choose any superhero to be your sidekick as Mighty Mer, who would it be and why?
My sidekick. Wow. There's so many choices for so many reasons. I mean, of course, you know, my mind goes to Aqualad, but I think it's because of the crush I had on Wil Wheaton as a child, and he voices Aqualad in Teen Titans. So if Aqualad did manifest and did not have Wil Wheaton's voice, I would be gravely disappointed and be stuck with Aqualad as my sidekick. So let's not say Aqualad. Actually, sticking with the Teen Titans, I'm going to say Raven. She reminds me way too much of my college roommate in always looks, mood. Yeah. So except for the powers, unless my college roommate was just hiding powers from me. So, yeah, I would like Raven to manifest as my college roommate, but with powers.
Cool. Something that we have in common with many other people, that we're very bookish people. And I was wondering if you have any strange book habits. I know that lots of people like to smell new books, and I know someone who likes to lick books, would you believe? Is there anything that you do that's a strange book habit?
Please tell me you don't spend a whole lot of time with the person who licks books, because that does not sound like someone you want to have in polite company.
She's actually very fabulous.
I would not have them over at my house.
Admittedly, I haven't invited her to my house and left her alone with my books. It has to be said.
Okay, okay. Strange book habits. I don't know of any strange ones. I have habits. I have, you know, I buy too many and they pile up. And because I have a podcast with that talks about authors and books, I get a lot of books from publishers. Sometimes publishers send me an advanced reader's copy and a final copy. So sometimes I have two copies of books lying around, and my husband wonders what we're going to have to do with all these books. And then I take a big stack of them to Goodwill. Here we go. I take books to Goodwill that I'm not going to read. And then they judge me there because you see someone take a big box of books and you wonder, why aren't you reading these books? How can you throw away books? You're a terrible person. And, you know, I was bringing box after box because I let them mount up for about 2 years. And again, these are the books that come to me from publishers. I don't buy them or solicit them. And I need to, you know, walk around my house and not have a fire hazard and not be on the show Hoarders. So I go to Goodwill and get judged by the people who work there. That's probably the strangest habit I have, is getting judged by Goodwill people.
Are you someone who strokes covers? I'm a stroker.
I'm not. I don't find books sexy. I don't.
I'm not saying that it's...
No. You're delighting in your physical experience with the book.
This is not a sexual.
Sexy is a bit of a metaphor, but it's sexy. You're stroking something. There's something pleasurable about that. I'm not judging.
There's something sensual, I would say.
Sensual. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, it's, you know, especially the ones which have got, like, the little raised bits or the spot UV.
Yeah, I'm kind of a book abuser.
Oh, my life. This is turning into quite a confession.
And I know. And I get so careful when, you know, my husband and I are very close, very happy, and we do have our, you know, the things that are his and the things that are mine. And, you know, when I read one of my books, I'll do anything to it. But I know if I pick up one of his books, I must treat it very well. And, you know, that's very well compared to my treatment of books. Yeah, I have to make sure whose book I'm reading and how I treat it.
Yes, I think I'm probably on the side of your husband. I'm one of these people that worries about the spine cracking. And
Yes, he does that.
Yeah, I'm with him on that, I'm afraid.
I just remember my mother's copy of Shogun.
One of my favorite books ever.
And it was held together by a fat rubber band because she'd read it so many times it had just started to fall apart. And I looked at that book and all I saw was love because she loved that book so much it was falling apart. Maybe I'm just giving in to my natural nature, but I sort of see things like small dings here and there or stains as... You know, it's a mark of passage of time. And yes, your book can be a perfect, like new, as they say on eBay. Or, you know, you can say, oh, right, that was the time I spilled coffee when I was 27 and I was reading that book. And, you know, it's like a mark of history. So it's not saying I just completely shit all over my books. I love them very much. And I do have a collection that I do take very good care of. But I'm not going to freak out if something gets torn or something gets spilled, because that's just not the way I am.
I think it's actually a very healthy way to be. I wish I could be more like that, but I'm a bit too neurotic. And I'm getting worse as I get older, I'm sure. I'm starting to get really set in my ways and freak out about the stupidest things. I wish I could be more relaxed about stuff like that.
I think out about all sorts of stuff, just
not the books.
Yeah.
Being a writer today, I think we're in interesting times. There are
All
of these opportunities that people have never had before, and there are all kinds of upheavals and disruptions and wonderful things happening as well. I was wondering, in your opinion, what is the greatest challenge that writers have today?
I would say the greatest challenge is understanding every option that is available to you and every side of every option. Writing is exciting. Seeing your name on the cover of a book is exciting. Researching agents is not exciting. Understanding Amazon's terms of service is not exciting. And so many people, you know, they'll research the kind of feathers that were on a certain arrow in a certain time period exhaustively, but they won't read what Smashwords needs you to do to your book that's different from what Amazon needs you to do to your book if you're self-publishing. And what confuses me is that there's so much information that's readily available. You know, I'm 40, so I'm on that. I clearly remember life before the internet, but my life has been heavily influenced by the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had many, many years online as opposed and offline. And so I remember having to look up agent stuff and editor stuff and that big fat Writer's Digest book that was already out of, what's the word I'm looking for? Obsolete by the time it went to print.
Yeah.
Because things had already changed. And it's exciting that all that stuff is available, but people won't look it up. And then some people get heavily, heavily on one side or the other and then start marching as if these are our generals and we are part of their army. I don't think Amazon gives a crap about me as an author, and I don't think my publisher really cares whether I take up arms and go against self-publishing, but there are people who do both sides, and I'm thinking, well, the information's right there. You can read up on it and learn. And, you know, you go to cons and you hear people talking about, oh, the big five and how evil they are, and then you hear people talking about how stupid self-publishers are because they don't understand this or that, or and it gets very divisive, and there's so much information out there and so many choices, and I believe we all need to understand what those are.
Yes, I agree.
Boy, I talked a lot. How are you?
No, I think that's it all makes a lot of sense. The last time we saw each other was in America, and it was at last year's Worldcon.
Yes, San Antonio.
Yeah, and it was unbearably hot, and you won the Campbell.
Those two things were not connected. Yes,
they were not.
And you wore awesome clothing, and it was hot.
Yeah, I wore very, very ill-advised clothing.
You looked amazing.
Yeah, but I was so very hot, it nearly killed me.
Oh, God, I believe it.
It was okay when we didn't have to go outside, but when I had to go outside, it was awful. But anyway, you were nominated for the Campbell, which you won at that award ceremony. Now, I was wondering if you have any advice for other people who may have been nominated for things this year and who will be in the awards ceremony waiting to hear who the winner is. What's your advice for those poor souls? I'm asking for a friend.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Don't say, oh, shit, if you lose. Don't listen to anybody who says they voted for you. And try not to listen to anybody who say they didn't. My first year, so many people told me, A, that they voted for me, and B, that they thought I was going to win. And I didn't want to believe it, but it did get sort of a bit of a hoax set up. I came in fourth. I wasn't even close. And so last year I knew how to lose. So I was all ready. I knew exactly how to get up there and lose. Gosh. A lot of people I know who are nominated are very polite and know not to say bad things about the other people nominated and eventually probably the person who wins, if it's not them, online. But that needs to be said. You don't need to complain or say horrible things online because it just makes you look like sour grapes.
I think that could be applied across the board for everything as well.
Yes.
Don't be horrible.
Don't be horrible.
Yeah.
There are many perks that come with being nominated, including a snazzy little pin and invitations to parties. Take as much glee in enjoying those as you can. Remember that there are, gosh, probably over 100 people nominated and very few people win. I remember the first year I felt like the only loser, which was ridiculous, because there were so many losers around me, but I felt like I was the loser, like I had been pointed out as the fraud, like all of my fears had come true. That was stupid. So, but the thing is, I can't tell you to manage your emotions. I can just tell you what I went through.
I think the imposter syndrome thing is something that we all wrestle with.
Yes,
all the time as well.
I didn't expect to feel it came true if I lost an award, because only 5 people are nominated, and it is a great honor. Yeah, it sounds like bullshit, honor to be nominated, but you are considered one of the top 5 or 6 or 4 or whatever your category is, and that's pretty amazing as it is. Oh, if you win, I will tell you that it's difficult both after you lose and after you win to write, because if you're sad after you lose, you may be depressed and not feel like writing because what's it all for? A mutual friend of ours, I'll tell you later, once said, yeah, but we don't write for that. And I put it on a label maker and put it above my desk to remind myself what we write for, because it's not that. But being sad and wondering what it's all for, wondering if it's worth it, can happen after you lose. But after you win, the imposter syndrome can crash down on you, and you could think, well, everyone's looking at me now. Is the next thing I produce going to prove all the people who said I couldn't do it, going to prove them right? Is it? Am I going to be able to live up to what everyone said I was able to do last time? And that is, it's frightening. I had Paolo Bacigalupi come up to me last year and just say, look, take a couple of days to enjoy this before you return to the pit of self-loathing. And my husband's beside me, and he's like, thank you so much for saying that. And this is Paolo Bacigalupi, man. Apparently he knows the pit of self-loathing. He's there with me.
You know, that's the thing that I'm starting to really appreciate, becoming friends with so many people that whose careers, I think, my goodness, I would love to have a fraction of the success you have. And then learning that they are just as terrified and many times miserable as I am, and full of doubt and, you know, to the extent where I think, my goodness, is this a happy career to go into? But it's one of those things we have to do.
Yeah, it's a good thing and a bad thing. It's good to know that all these people who are amazing are just like you, which means you can be just like them. And it's also sad to think that you're not going to elevate yourself out of this pit of shit we're all standing in.
No.
Oh, there's Paolo standing in shit too. I just thought your shit smelled better, but it doesn't.
No, we just have to have a drink together and laugh about it whenever we can.
Exactly, yes. And my friend, I hope I can say this. My friend Ursula won the Best Graphic Story Hugo 2 years ago. And afterwards, she talked with her publisher, and they looked at the sales spike after the Hugos. And she realized that a Hugo is worth, at least in the graphic story world, $1,600.
Huh.
Because that was the spike of sales that happened after the Hugos, and then the sales went back to normal afterward. So, you know, it's like we think it's so huge, and then, you know, you look around and think, oh, well, the world's still turning. It's like it's huge, but then you got to remember that it's small, but then you got to remember that whether you win or lose, you got to get up the next morning and write or record.
Yeah, it is a strange, strange thing. I mean, I've been to two Hugo's ceremonies now and the parties beforehand just with friends, having nothing, you know, no stakes in the evening at all. And even then, I got really nervous for my friends.
Yeah.
And now, being one of those people, I'm thinking, oh no, am I actually going to be functional?
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's a weird thought, but it's a lovely thought as well.
Oh, and don't be superstitious, and don't think that if you write a speech, you'll win, or if you don't write a speech, you'll win, or if you do write one, you won't. I mean, that's all bullshit. You know, you need to have a speech. You got to have a speech, because otherwise you'll get up there and either stumble around or ramble. And, you know, if you freak out or cry, that's endearing. People love that. But if you get up there and just don't know what to say, you'll look, it's almost like you disrespected the award by not being prepared to accept it.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to move on because I'm starting to get nervous.
No.
When I'm going to have a friend for tea, I like to ask on the Twitters if anybody else who is not in a position to have tea with you, if they have a question they would like to ask.
Uh-oh.
And one I really caught my eye, actually, and the question was, which is harder, to give writing advice or to follow writing advice?
Follow. The writing advice that I give is the writing advice that I have trouble following. I'm saying my podcast is for me. You know, I'm glad that other people get stuff out of it. And obviously it's for an audience, or else I would just sit there and talk to myself in my room. But the fact that I have a recorder on makes it cool and beneficial instead of really sad and a little worrisome. It's just pushing that button. It changes everything. No, all the stuff I say, I have trouble with. The biggest thing has been Find the right agent. Dear God, find the right agent. None of my agents have been bad or crooks or someone you would find written up on Absolute Right or Predators and Editors. They just weren't right for me. And I did that over and over again, still saying on my podcast, find the right agent. And seriously, it's so much harder to follow the advice. I was recently doing research on creating magic systems. And I thought, well, you know, I've never really created a full magic system before, so I'm going to read up on it. And everything I read, I already knew. And, you know, I felt kind of good about that, but then I felt kind of annoyed that I couldn't find anything, any sort of magic bullet to make me confident in writing the magic system. But I'm like, you know, knowing the advice and actually following it, those are two big things. So I have my podcast so I can remind myself of all that advice, because it's honestly difficult to follow. And I know that.
Your Shambling Guides books.
Yes.
I understand the second one came out quite recently in March.
Yes.
That's the Ghost Train to New Orleans.
Yes.
So, could you tell me about that?
Yes, definitely. The Shambling Guides are a story of, I like to say, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy meets Neverwhere. It's a woman who writes travel books for monsters. And she's human, and is being, it's an urban fantasy, and being she's being the having the wide-eyed introduction to the underworld of monsters trying to live among humans, trying to have a balance, because they know if they eat all the humans, well, then they won't have anything to eat, so they have to be careful. And there are, she finds out there are laws and even police for the monsters. And the first book, she writes a travel book about New York City. Mm-hmm. And, of course, all sorts of conflict and things fall apart. But she survives, and in the second book, she goes to New Orleans to write a travel book for that city. And it was a lot of fun to write. I did a little bit of research down there. Tried not to do the typical Bourbon Street, because that is where everyone goes to drink and see strippers and walk around with hurricane glasses and yell woohoo and show your tits and stuff like that. And found out there were many more interesting places in New Orleans, like Jackson Square, where all the cats come out at night.
Ooh.
Yes, yes. A lot of that book was either real or actually happened to me. She tries to do touristy things to know what to tell tourists to New Orleans to do, and she was trying to get away from her coworkers, who were understandably stressful to her, and so she goes on a vampire tour, and the vampire tour leader is very bad and says things like, when Dracula was written by Bram Stoker, and points out a tree where apparently people were hung, and sometimes if you take pictures of the tree, you can see the ghost in the picture, and then we all got distracted by this unneutered three-legged dog dragging a leash behind him, just hopping down the sidewalk. And he got very irritated with us watching this dog, because clearly this dog had a story. Because, you know, we're all about spay and neuter your pets, and he wasn't. And there was only three legs there, but he was dragging a leash. So did he get away from somebody? Is there somebody missing their three-legged dog up the road that way? I mean, we were very concerned about this dog, and this man was not happy with that. And so that got into the book. And yes, there are a bunch of cats who just gather at Jackson Square at night. So I got to put that in the book. You know, little things came out, like New Orleans is below sea level, and so they bury all their dead above ground. So there aren't any, like, tunnels or sewers like in New York or London that vampires can carefully go about their business during the day.
Okay.
So it's scarier in New Orleans for photophobic types. But it was a lot of fun to write, because it's, I always like looking at cities from different points of view and how you would have to get around a city if you were a vampire or a zombie, or how you would deal with finding food and still blending in. I mean, of course, you could just do Walking Dead and just decimate the whole place, but that's not the goal of the story.
Mm. As you know, that's one of my favorite things, being a writer, going to a place where a story is either brewing or is currently being written.
Yes.
And having that sense of unreality, that you're walking through it in the real world, but there's so much going on in your head or things that are leaping out that can work in the story that it becomes otherworld as well. And that's just such a thrilling experience.
It is.
So have you got a third one on the way for a different city?
No, I have some more plotted out, but I only had a 2-book contract.
So what would your ideal next city be?
Well, ideally London, partly because I'm going to LondCon, and I knew I would be there to do research. I'd like to do London. There are more American cities I would like to do, namely, I want to do something with the new dark god, the Mouse, in Orlando, Florida. And I want to do something with Emperor Norton, who was the first and only emperor of the United States, in San Francisco. I'm not sure what I want to do with Emperor Norton. I know I want to do something with him. So if I get to do a San Francisco book, Emperor Norton will be involved. If I get to do an Orlando book, the Mouse will be involved.
My last question, I don't know if you've noticed the chickens that are in the little pen over there. We couldn't give them free rein because we don't want them getting lost in Georgian Bath, of course. But they're rather unusual chickens that seem to know a huge number of songs. So I'd like to ask you, if you could choose a theme tune for your life, what would it be? And we'll see if the chickens know it.
Oh, boy. Chicken music. Well, I think my theme song feels like I'm a Winner by the Aquabats. I chose the username Mighty Murr as sort of a ironic thing, like calling a really big guy tiny. Because I don't feel mighty. I'm very low self-esteem, very frightened of just about everything. And I'm a Winner is a song about how, kind of like a loser guy trying really hard. And it's very singable and awesome. So I guess I'd go with I'm a Winner by the Aquabats.
Okay, little chickens. I'm a Winner by the Aquabats. Oh, and there they go.
Wow, I did not know they were that big over here in that time.
Well, I think it was Mike Cole had a theory about them having kind of not telekinetic. Well, good grief, can you imagine telekinetic chickens? That would be terrifying.
But boy, they would fly.
They would, and probably many other things.
Yeah.
But no, he had a theory about them having some kind of psychic connection. So, you know, it would make a lot of sense because I can't imagine how they could have been exposed to such a wide variety of music.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. I'm still on the telekinetic chickens, though. I would like to breed these and give some to my stepmother because she keeps having problems with dogs and hawks.
Oh.
And I'm pretty sure a telekinetic chicken could handle a dog or a hawk really well.
They could, but you know, we could unleash something awful on the world if we tried to breed these chickens to have specific qualities because a huge chunk of speculative fiction taught us that if you ever do anything like that, you kind of lead to the end of the world.
Or the Westminster Dog Show. One or the other. But really, you think telekinetic chickens could bring about the end of the world?
I think everything can bring about the end of the world. I worry.
I think I should challenge you. I think we should each write a story about telekinetic chickens and the end of the world. Dueling chicken stories. I don't have a gauntlet. I'm a lady. I'm throwing the polite white glove down next to the tea, Emma, and I'm throwing the challenge at you. Telekinetic chickens.
It is part of the challenge that it must lead to the end of the world?
I think it would be interesting if it did, but if you choose to imagine a future where telekinetic chickens do not lead to the end of the world, that would be okay. I think just telekinetic chickens are the way to go.
Okay. I will have a think about it.
Okay.
See what comes into my strange mind. There's probably something lurking in a dark crevice or two in there that I could work with. That's one of the strangest things that has ever happened to me when I've taken tea with somebody. Well done. And believe me, many strange things have happened when I've taken tea with friends. But I think that is definitely it. Well, let's have a look in this tea. We've run out of tea, I'm afraid.
We have. Where's your butler?
Well, he's making sure that everything is still safe for us to get back home. We've had some difficulties with time travel and things, and I've given him strict instructions to make sure that we can get home safely. Seeing as we've run out of tea, why don't we put on these hats and coats that he's secured for us? Goodness knows where from, let's not ask.
Okay.
And have a stroll outside before we go back home.
Lovely.
Look, over there, the lady selling buns. That must be Solange Lyon, better known as Sally Lunn. The one who invented the cake we've just been eating.
Have you spotted the rather sinister gentleman sneaking up behind her?
He's got a knife.
And a dashing goatee beard.
He's going to attack her. Surely not because she put currants in the buns.
Do not judge a lady by her currants. She doesn't deserve to die for currants.
What is she doing with her sword, Latimer?
I believe she's shaving off his beard, Mum.
He doesn't look nearly as scary without the goatee. It seems he doesn't have the stomach for the attack now. That was amazing, Mer. You saved Sally Lunn. Oh, that man must have been from the Anti-Cake League. They were trying to kill her before the bun that she makes became famous. It's like Terminator, but with a cake instead of a human resistance leader.
Wow.
How did you know that the beard was the source of his power?
It was dastardly. You've seen plenty of gentlemen. Have you ever seen one with a dastardly beard?
Well, the one just then and at another time, actually. He was associated with the Anti-Cake League.
See?
Yeah, yeah, you've got a good eye for this stuff.
Thank you.
So, removing the beard removes the dastardliness and he ran away.
Yes.
I'll bear that in mind for the future.
Be safe.
Thanks, Mer. I think it's time to go home. While Latimer opens the time portal for us, I'd just like to mention our very own Patreon page, where you can become a member of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Speaking of which, I'd like to raise my teacup to Fred Kish. Should you wish to become a member, simply go to www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy. And if you do join us, you'll be able to discover how Latimer became my butler and learn about our very first adventure together. Now normally I'd ask you a question before we part ways, but instead I'd like to take a moment to say goodbye to Jay Lake, who recently passed away. He was beloved by our community and taken from us too soon. I raise my cup of tea to you, Mr. Lake, and pass on my condolences to your loved ones.
The portal is open, Mum.
Splendid. Oh, and Latimer, the next time we travel to another period that requires hats, please could you find one for me that doesn't have a giant pink feather? It's not really to my taste.
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of TN's Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman. Go to www.tandjeopardy.com to find out more and join in.